Today is Thursday, October 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. House of Representatives took to the floor to vote on the rules regarding the Democrat-led impeachment inquiry, with Republicans continuing to cry foul.
The unfairness is clear. This is not a fair process, nor was it ever intended to be. It was preordained from the beginning.
But is that the case? We hear from a lawyer who's also a constitutional law expert. And we take a look at the significance of the Washington Nationals winning the World Series. Those stories and more are next. Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives took a crucial step forward in their impeachment investigation of U.S. President Donald Trump on Thursday. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced a vote formalizing the inquiry, addressing Republicans' arguments the process is illegitimate. Oklahoma Congressman Tim Cole, the House Rules Committee's top Republican, says the Democrats plan to deny President Trump his rights.
The unfairness is clear. This is not a fair process, nor was it ever intended to be. It was preordained from the beginning.
Although House Rules Committee Chairman Democrat Jim McGovern says the process is proper.
It's about transparency and it's about due process for the president. Some on the other side will never be satisfied with any process that uncovers the truth of what the president did.
He went on to say that the Democrats are simply doing their jobs.
We are not here in some partisan exercise. We are here because the facts compel us to be here. There is serious evidence that President Trump may have violated the Constitution.
Cole asserted that the American people will not see the impeachment as legitimate.
A legitimate process is one that offers protections for everyone involved. And without those protections, this will be seen as just another partisan exercise, one the majority has been pushing since the very first days of the 116th Congress.
The White House responded by saying the president has done nothing wrong and that the Democrats know it. Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats' unhinged obsession with this illegitimate impeachment proceeding does not hurt President Trump. It hurts the American people. Mr. Trump's former top advisor for Russian and European affairs arrived on Capitol Hill Thursday to testify to House impeachment investigators a day after leaving his job at the White House. The AP's Sagar Murgadi has more.
Tim Morrison's testimony comes a day after he stepped down as the National Security Council's Russia and European Affairs chief. He's the first White House political appointee to testify in the probe, and what he says may be central in a push to remove the president from office. Morrison was in the middle of an in-house fight over Rudy Giuliani's activities in Ukraine and will be asked to explain the sinking feeling he said he got when the president demanded Ukraine investigate Joe Biden and 2016 election meddling. Morrison's testimony comes even as the House votes on a resolution setting ground rules for impeachment, which the Democrat-led chamber is certain to approve. Sagar Magani, Washington.
To dive deeper into the rules voted on today, I spoke with Joel Paul, a professor at the University of California Hastings Law School. I began by asking him what he thought of the Democrats' process.
So the House does have the authority to determine the rules, and it has been the practice of the House in the previous three impeachment inquiries for the party in power to write the rules in a way that's consistent with their interests. The rules, as I understand them, that the House has adopted, are pretty consistent with the previous practice with regard to the Clinton impeachment. The one respect in which they differ is that the impeachment inquiry is going to move forward now in the Intelligence Committee, which is then going to prepare a report to the Judiciary Committee. And the Judiciary Committee will then allow, at that point, the President's counsel to participate in the hearings to the extent that the administration cooperates in providing in responding to subpoenas and providing witnesses. And that is the one respect in which the chairman of the Judiciary Committee has the authority to remove the president's counsel if the president doesn't cooperate. So it provides a kind of carrot and stick for the White House to participate in the inquiry. That's the only respect in which I think it differs significantly from previous impeachment inquiries.
Up until this point, there's been this impeachment inquiry, and a lot of people have made it analogous to a grand jury testimony with a lot of closed doors, hearings, and whatnot. Does keeping it in the Intelligence Committee a kind of extend that but make it more public before it goes to the Judiciary Committee where it has traditionally been?
Well, I think that the reason that it's in the Intelligence Committee to begin with is because, to a large extent, a lot of the information is classified information. The identity of the whistleblower is still secret, and they want to maintain the secrecy of the whistleblower's identity. So it makes some sense to keep it there. Also, I think in some ways it's a reflection of the fact that Adam Schiff, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, is a very gifted prosecutor, and you know, he's handled this in a very skilled way from a prosecutorial point of view. So My suspicion is they want the committee to finish up the report and then let the Judiciary Committee draft articles of impeachment if articles of impeachment are anticipated.
During this process, you mentioned that the president and the White House will have the ability to have counsel in the Judiciary Committee. And you kind of alluded to this before, that it tracks with previous iterations of impeachment inquiries within the House. Does that really answer all the concerns from Republicans as far as the process being transparent and fair?
I think that the Republicans' concern with regard to transparency is not warranted. But the Republicans' concern that the Democrats have had an obsession with trying to impeach the president, you know, might be a legitimate concern. I think that, you know, I think a reasonable person could question whether the Democrats should have opened up the hearings at the first stage in the Intelligence Committee, but everything that was done in the Intelligence Committee up to this point will now be made public to the extent that it's relevant to the president's impeachment. So the transparency concerns are not genuine. But there are concerns, I think, that Democrats, you know, have pursued the impeachment now for some time. But that may simply reflect the fact that the president has given them numerous potential grounds for impeachment. So it's sort of hard to say whether Democrats have been unfair or not to the president. In any event, the particular grounds that are now moving forward, all of the information, all of the evidence will be made public, will be transparent. And the American people will have a chance to decide whether or not this impeachment is warranted.
Joel Paul is a professor at the University of California Hastings School of Law. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Steve.
More details from the daring U.S. military raid that took out Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi Saturday. Once a powerful self-declared caliphate, Baghdadi was found hiding in a tunnel, cornered with no exit, and he blew himself up and his three children. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more on what the U.S. officials picked up in the raid and how they plan to protect resources to keep the ISIS fight going full steam ahead.
Aerial footage shows U.S. forces taking out hostile fighters who had fired on the helicopters during their approach. Armed with compound details and power in the skies, the commander in charge of the raid said U.S. forces moved in on Baghdadi's location.
He crawled into a hole with two small children and blew himself up while his people stayed on the ground. You can deduce what kind of person it is based on that activity.
Footage shows U.S. air power leveling the area after stripping data from the compound, taking two prisoners, and collecting Baghdadi's remains.
The way it looked afterwards, so it's pretty clear that the success of the standoff munitions that we employed ensure that it would not be a shrine or otherwise memorable in any way. It's just another piece of ground.
But the general cautioned Baghdadi's death isn't the end of Islamic State.
They will be dangerous. We suspect they will try some form of retribution attack. ISIS is first and last in ideology, so we're under no illusions that it's going to go away just because we kill Baghdadi.
The latest footage, a vivid display of U.S. determination to bring the terror group to justice. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
British and Belgian police are continuing to investigate the people smuggling networks that helped transport the 39 migrants who were found dead in the back of a refrigerated truck near London last week. It's believed they suffocated in the sealed container. Many of the victims were apparently Vietnamese, and authorities suspect they traveled across the border to China, then to Russia and to Europe before crossing the English Channel from the port of Zeebrugge. Henry Ridgewell reports on the growing industry in human cargo that brings tens of thousands of migrants to Europe every year.
An industrial park east of London, the tragic end to a journey that began with hope 9,000 kilometers away in the remote villages of northern Vietnam. Identities have not been confirmed, but the grieving has already begun. Sons and daughters seemingly lost to the brutal trade in people smuggling. Bui Phan Chin believes his son was among those who died. Many people in this village have gone abroad to work, he says, so my son wanted to go abroad like others to earn money. That demand is catered for by well-established gangs, says Phil Robertson of Human Rights Watch.
These are groups and gangs that operate with impunity in Vietnam. In many cases, they have connections to official authorities, so there is that corruption element going on that allows them to offer to get people to places in Europe.
Family members say they paid these gangs up to $38,000 to reach Europe. Criminologist Paolo Campana is an expert on people smuggling networks.
What we see is a fragmentation and a compartmentalization of the smuggling. So in a sense, you don't have a Mr. Big controlling everything, but you have fairly small, rudimentary organizations that might take care of each stage in the journey.
Campana says the human cargo is transferred at handover points en route.
Migrants have to make incredibly difficult decisions over whether to trust smuggler A or smuggler B. Word of mouth plays a very large role. In other cases, for instance, the Syrians or the Iraqi, you also have Facebook groups or forums on the internet where smugglers advertise their services, and migrants can ask questions and can try to get more information about the service provided by the smugglers.
The driver of the truck, Morris Robinson from Northern Ireland, has been charged with manslaughter, human trafficking, and money laundering.
I would be very surprised if the people who were involved in the last leg of the journey, whoever they have been, they would have any knowledge about what has happened in China or in Russia or in Eastern Europe.
British police are searching for others thought to be involved. Detective Chief Inspector Martin Pasmore is leading the investigation.
We have people coming into the country, either being trafficked or as asylum seekers. And we know that the borders are very tight and complicated, and there are more and more chances being taken.
That chance ended in tragedy for 39 migrants seeking a better life. Again, Phil Robertson of Human Rights Watch.
There has to be, real pressure on Vietnam also to end these kind of people smuggling arrangements.
Experts say clamping down on people smuggling gangs requires better cross-border cooperation. But as long as there is demand, the gangs will continue to prosper, and this will unlikely be the last tragedy. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Two new studies provide more evidence that avocados are good for you. A Penn State University study gives a new take on the old adage, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. Study authors provide evidence that eating an avocado a day may help keep LDL or bad cholesterol at bay. The study specifically found that eating avocados helped cut down the amount of oxidized LDL particles. It's known how oxygen can damage food, like when an apple turns brown. Researchers say that oxidation medication is also bad for the human body. The other study from Canada's University of Guelph suggests avocados could help people manage obesity and delay or prevent diabetes. The study authors show for the first time how avocatin B, a compound found only in avocados, can constrain the cellular processes that normally lead to diabetes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Hong Kong authorities braced as pro-democracy protesters urged people on Thursday to defy a government ban on face coverings and celebrate Halloween by wearing masks during a protest march. Also, anti-government protesters in Hong Kong say they were seeking greater rights and freedoms amid what they perceive as growing repression by Beijing. That's a call that resonates with the city's sexual minorities who are looking across South China Sea to Taiwan, another semi-autonomous Chinese territory that has challenged China's strict legal views on gay marriage. Lebanese security forces were still struggling to open some roads Thursday as protesters continued their civil disobedience campaign in support of nationwide anti-government demonstrations. Schools had been set to reopen for the first time in 2 weeks, but late Wednesday, many parents received text messages saying their schools would remain closed for security reasons. Banks, schools, and many businesses have been shuttered since mass protests erupted on October 17th. After it was announced there would be attacks on the WhatsApp messenger service. A car bomb killed at least 8 people Thursday in a vegetable market in the northern region of Syria held by Turkish-led forces. Turkey's official Anadolu news agency said another 14 were wounded in the attack. It said the explosives were packed into a refrigerated truck. Turkish-led forces captured Afrin from Syrian Kurdish fighters early last year. The area is controlled by Syrian fighters allied with Turkey, who have been accused by rights groups of seizing land and property. The area sees sporadic attacks and other violence. Syria's state-run Sana news agency also reported the attack, saying at least 9 people were killed and 20 were wounded. It said the blast ignited a nearby patrol station that caused damage to surrounding homes and shops. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack. A fire swept through a Pakistani train on Thursday, killing at least 74 people and injuring nearly 40 after a gas canister that passengers were using to cook breakfast exploded, according to government officials. Reuters' Megan Ravel reports.
A fire swept through a Pakistani train on Thursday, killing scores of people and injuring nearly 40 in the country's worst rail disaster in nearly 15 years. Government officials said a gas canister exploded, which passengers were using to cook breakfast. But several survivors questioned the official line, saying they believed it was due to a fault with the train's electrical system. The disaster occurred in the south of Punjab province. The train was travelling from Karachi to the city of Rawalpindi, where a religious conference is taking place. Many died after leaping from the moving train, trying to escape the flames. Pakistan's colonial-era railway has fallen into disrepair due to chronic underinvestment and poor maintenance, meaning accidents are all too common.
And that was Reuters reporter Megan Ravel. In Asia, North Korea fired 2 short-range projectiles, likely ballistic missiles, toward the sea off its east coast, according to South Korea and Japanese authorities. It's the 12th such launch by North Korea this year. The launch comes as North Korea ramps up pressure ahead of its end-of-year deadline for the United States to change its approach to stalled nuclear talks. Earlier this week, North Korea warned the United States it would be seriously mistaken if it ignores the deadline. South Korea's military said the projectiles, which were launched from the Suncheon region of South Pyongan province, flew about 370 kilometers and reached an altitude of about 90 kilometers. Japanese officials say the projectiles were probably ballistic missiles and landed outside Japan's exclusive economic zone, which extends some 370 kilometers off its coast. Kim Yong-chol, a senior North Korean official, on Sunday warned the U.S. against using the Trump-Kim relationship as a delaying tactic, cautioning that Pyongyang was running out of patience with Washington. Pyongyang has warned it would soon resume long-range missiles or nuclear tests. Such a move would be a severe setback to nuclear negotiations. President Trump has said that he has no problem with North Korea's short-range launches since they cannot reach the United States. However, North Korea seems intent on gradually testing more advanced weapons, and in early October, it tested a medium-range ballistic missile designed to be launched from a submarine. After a terrible start to the season, the Washington Nationals recovered and made their way to the World Series as a wild card team. After winning the first two games of the 115th World Series on the road in Houston, they lost all three games here at home to the Astros. Facing elimination, the Nationals returned to Houston, Texas to win six games to tie the series up. And on Wednesday night, came out on top once more to win the series. A Washington Nationals fan who braved the rain to watch the finale on a big screen television at the stadium in the nation's capital reacted to the World Series win.
I am stunned! I am amazed! I am overjoyed!
Now joining us in the studio, the host of VOA Sunnyside of Sports, Sonny Young. Sporty greetings, sir.
Sporty greetings, Steve. Lots of overjoyed fans here in the nation's capital.
And in full disclosure, I was one of those at the stadium sitting in the rain last night.
Well, I know the rain didn't dampen your spirits any, Steve.
No, and I'm very pleased about that because I, you know, being on the radio, our voices are very important, and I did not want to come away with the flu.
Well, I must say, I never dreamed the Nationals would win four games in Houston, as they did. Never been done before, a road team winning four games on the opponent's ground, so to speak. It was really very much a roller coaster type of World Series.
Yes, and like we mentioned yesterday, in this series, no one at home won, not once. It was always the road teams in the World Series that came away with the W.
We were talking just before airtime about just the remarkable comeback kid nature of the Nationals. They were faced with five elimination games. That means during the playoffs, if they lost that game, they were out of the playoffs. They trailed in all five of those games, but came back to win, including last night in Houston. They won 6-2 after trailing 2-0. Just a very resilient type of team. The manager of the Nationals, Dave Martinez, during the trophy presentation ceremony, he described the Nats as a relentless and resilient bunch of guys. Lots of resiliency with that team.
No, I mean, it was amazing to watch the game, not only last night, but the entire series. And both teams really came prepared. I mean, it was a great series. You know, you always want your home team to crush the opposition, to go four and out. But as a true sports fan, you know, game seven is what I like to see.
It doesn't get much bigger than that. And the Astros, the best team really in baseball this season. I think they won 107 games. Third year in a row, they had won more than 100 games. World Series champions 2 years ago. Lots of great players. Altuve from Venezuela. What a slugger. But yeah, the Nats prevailed. And so I'm looking forward to that big parade on Saturday, Steve.
Before we get to the parade, we have about 30 seconds left. How significant is it for the win from the Nationals? I mean, we have every sport team here.
I would rate it right up there in terms of title teams here in Washington. The ice hockey team, the Capitals, won the Stanley Cup a few years ago. The Mystics won the WNBA title just recently. But baseball, the national pastime, one of the top sports. And historically, the last World Series title in Washington almost 100 years ago, 1924. Right. So this was really big.
Almost Cub-worthy. You know, we talk about the drought that the Cubs had as well. And that's going to do it for us today. Thank you so much, Sonny, for stopping by. You have been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, our engineer, Mr. Chang, and managing editor, Paul Alexander, as well as our special guest in the studio, host of VOA's Sunny Side of Sports, Sonny Young. We'll see you next time. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.